I think that the power of science fiction is not only in prediction of any kind of technology, but also in understanding of how humans will act in new kind of situation. Because we still are the same humans, and the situation changes, and how are we going to act and how are we going to be in this all new kind of situations? That's the real question.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the EVN Disrupt podcast. My name is Nejdet Zaturyan. I'm the editor of the tech section here at EVN Report. Our guest this week was Hovhannes Gulogelian, the co-founder and CEO of Groksmith. We spoke about Hovhannes' journey to entrepreneurship and the concept of venture building, an approach to spinning startups out of development agencies. We also spoke about Hovhannes' thoughts on the entire life cycle of a startup, from ideation to development, and what areas he believes are worth investing time into today. We particularly dove into the topic of energy and the role AI can play in better managing energy resources. Lastly, we spoke about science fiction and its ability to help us imagine the future and society's relationship with technology. Thank you for listening. Hovhannes, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been wanting to do this for a long time. I'm excited that we're finally doing it. Let's start with understanding a little bit of your background. Tell me how you got into the world of tech.
Oh, that's a long story.
We have a lot of time.
Yeah. So I'm a physicist by education, and I've done a bit of science in physics. I've worked in cosmology.
You did a PhD?
Yeah, I did a PhD there. But cosmology is kind of very theoretical thing. So, and my character is more like I'm a practical man. So I wanted to do something with impact that can change the lives of people, of humans. So I've started doing business as any physicist. I've also were doing like a lot of programming at that time. During the last couple of years of my PhD program, I started doing some business activities. My first like business, a loyalty program or something like that. Yeah.
For what?
For local businesses in Yerevan.
Okay, like a general loyalty.
Yeah.
What year was that?
2007.
Okay.
Or five, I don't remember.
Did you get any traction with it?
I think so. I had a few clients back then, yeah. Then I started working in a startup as a programmer, and I loved it. I've also worked in a couple of different companies in Mergelen Institute. Basically, my whole career as a programmer and as a business developer and as a CEO and in all the positions that I've worked is somehow connected with startups.
Right. Why not leave it at engineering? Like, so you wanted to have practical impact and cosmology was too theoretical, but you could have been an engineer and built a lot of great things that
that's the same reason. If you want to have a real impact, you need to work on a different abstraction levels. I love engineering, I love science, but working with people is the most interesting thing. And people are the most interesting objects to to learn about. So
it also gives you the fullest picture of what you're having an impact on.
Yes, and physics didn't give me like all the answers to my questions. So that's why I changed the field where I work with time to get more answers, to learn more, to understand more how everything works.
What do you mean? What were your questions?
Oh, that's a long story again.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. Basically, physics gives you a way to model a world. So it gives you instruments to model the world and to build models of real world objects, processes, everything. So it gives you a methodology to think. In that way, it's very effective. So it gives you a very good understanding of what's happening. But it is focused only on like a physical world.
Right.
If you want to get answers in other fields, you need to start learning and working in those fields. Only like by understanding the objective world, you cannot have a full understanding of how everything works.
Like you mean like at the psychological layer, like behavioral level, things like that? Yeah.
Like sociological layer and like psychological and everything.
Yeah. Do you think a physics education is, like, I've always theorized that if you don't know exactly what you want to do, but if you're capable enough, you should study either math or physics, because regardless of what you end up doing afterwards, being able to think at that level about problems and topics that you are trained to do in physics is the best preparation for almost anything. Is that something that you think has served you well in your career? Or?
When I was in 10th grade, my physics teacher said to me, if you go to physics department in state university, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
If you go to the math, you will do only math or only programming. That's why I chose physics.
And then eventually you land in starting what I think you're probably best known for, which is Groksmith. So tell us about Groksmith and the story of that.
Yeah, so before Groksmith, my friend Tigran and I, my co-founder, we worked in a different company. We also built startups there. So I was the CTO of the company, and then after me, he was the CTO. We both were the CTOs of the company. And then we decided to start our own business. So and we thought about what we can do. And the first thing was to continue serving startups.
Mm-hmm.
So we started as a kind of full cycle service company for startups. And we did product development and software development, and also product marketing for startups. It's a kind of from the ideation stage to then implementation and going to market, kind of full cycle service for startups. You help startups depending on what stage are they currently mm-hmm. in and what their needs are at the
as
moment.
A service.
Yeah. We did it as a service, and at some point we started also doing as a co-founder, so-called startup studio or venture builder model. And we work with a few startups in that model. We've co-founded or we've partnered up with maybe 5 startups.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of a different story when you work with with the CEOs, with the co-founders of startups. Is quite different from what you do as a service company.
Yeah.
Because
you're more of a say, you're more involved in the process.
Yeah, you're an investor, you're a VC, you're a builder of the company, and you're a service company at the same time. So mm-hmm. all of that combined together, different story. And you learn to work with co-founders, with the founders of the companies, and learn to understand them and choose them wisely.
I remember like in the mid-2010s, maybe even a little bit earlier, like 2013, 2014, this idea of venture building became popularized by, especially in the Valley. I know it's an even older model than that, but at the time, like there are some prominent entrepreneurs like Kevin Rose started a venture studio. But at some point, I remember this model being criticized for maybe like its lack of like practicality around, or maybe like underestimating how hard it is to have a team that will sort of take that product that's built internally within the original venture builder company and then spin it out into something that becomes sort of a standalone. And these days I feel like I hear less about venture building as a model. What's your take? Like, what do you think about the viability of it?
I think if you have a great team, then most probably it's doable, but it's not only your team. In Armenia, what we had as a big problem is the number of startups. So if you want to run it as a business, you maybe need like 10 startups in a year,
mm-hmm.
and you need to source those 10 startups.
The 10 teams.
Yeah, the 10 teams, 10 founders, and the founders... is the bottleneck in right. Armenia. Yeah, you don't have enough founders in Armenia.
And like exec level talent.
Yes. Yeah. So if you want 10 great startups, which that are also want to work with you, that's really hard in Armenia. You need to source them from the US, from other countries.
Yeah.
Yeah, so building the venture builder company in Armenia, only in Armenia, is very hard in that terms.
Do you think like some of there's initiatives like, for example, Hero House Glendale, part of which like Ashot has said on this show, for instance, of like the idea is that Hero House Glendale is based in LA, obviously, where there's a large Armenian population of people who have maybe some of that experience that is harder to find in Armenia. And it serves as a bridge between those two ecosystems so that that talent can be available for Armenian companies. Do you think something, do you think bridges like that provide you with more opportunities to, to source teams of founders?
And we had that conversation with Ashot, and that's all, also one of the reasons why they established the Hero House in Glendale, because there are not enough startups in Armenia. We are still a small country, only 3 million. And if you want a streamlined process of sourcing startups, investing in them, and as you know, the startup statistics are very harsh. So you have only like 10%, maybe 5% of them being successful. So you need a lot of them. That's why establishing a Hero House in Glendale is a very important need.
And startups and talent, right? But one of the most successful projects that you guys spun out from Groksmith was Wirestock, right? Which today is in its space a leader. Tell us that story. Like, how did Wirestock get started within Groksmith?
So we partnered up with the Wirestock founding team. I think the MVP and a few first versions of the project inside the company. And once the Wirestock were ready to separate and become a separate independent company being able to raise funds and starting doing real business, they separated. But we continued to manage the partnership with them.
How does that work post-separation? What's Groksmith's involvement there?
Till this day, we helped them with some hard technical tasks from time to time. And some of the Groksmith team members went to Wirestock on some senior positions, including the CTO and also senior tech team members. But now it's mostly kind of investor or co-founder, and a startup relationship.
So were Mikhail, was Mikhail, for instance, at the time at Groksmith, or was the idea of the product was developed within Groksmith, and then you guys found Mikhail?
Mikhail worked at Pixart at that moment. Vlad was working at in Groksmith at the moment. And Vlad became the CTO of the company.
So what's Groksmith up to today?
During the recent couple of years, we did a lot of blockchain projects in EVM and Ethereum, like smart contract based companies and protocols and stuff. We're exploring new ways to do business right now because of the AI and no-code, low-code tools. I will give you an example. So one of our startups was called Breakeven. We started doing it in the company to manage. It was a kind of vertical SaaS for an agency like us. So the goal was to manage whole company processes, the finance, the HR, and everything inside one tool, instead of being scattered among like different tools from Dropbox, Google Drive, and stuff.
This is a tool you guys were building.
To get it in just one tool. As you can imagine, it's a very big software project. So we spent maybe a year developing it. A lot of product work, a lot of software work. If you want to make it or scalable or usable for other companies too. So it's a very big amount of work, and we spend a lot of money on it. I started doing it in Notion. Just started building the same tool in Notion. Because Notion allows to do that. It's so quick, and you can connect it to like external services. So I just myself, instead of a team of 8 people, I can do something similar, like maybe
in a weekend.
In a week or 2 weeks or so.
Yeah.
So this changes the whole understanding of how software companies will work in the future. Not many companies already use the AI tools and no-code tools and low-code tools, but with time, people will start using it, and the need for software developers will go lower and lower.
Yeah.
I mean, it's already hard for like junior people to find jobs.
Yeah.
You need to be very senior to really do something very technical, very hardcore, so that people need you.
Right.
But for juniors, it's really very hard already.
Yeah. Like the days of like having a company having a big budget to hire like 10 mm-hmm. front-end people is maybe in the past.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can do it. And our project managers do a lot of like front-end work.
Yeah.
Recently, they just build it.
Yeah. Yeah. So these platforms like No-Code that allow you to integrate or build your workflows for your company really in a custom way that is fits much better for you than something that is more out of the box, let's say, that you were thinking of. How do you envision the future of these businesses that used to build these workflows for these various niches or areas, like you mentioned, like vertical SaaS? Do you think it'll all go away and it'll just be generalized platforms in which just the user will customize it to their needs, or will there still be out of the box stuff that people would want to go to?
I think until you are in some very deep niche, which requires a lot of expertise in the industry, a lot of understanding of the business and how it works and the complex processes in it, you are doomed to die.
Interesting.
Unless you do something like that, or you do deep tech. Because if I can build a vertical SaaS for my company in Notion and sell it on a Notion marketplace for other companies like me, so they have it like ready in minutes, and then they can change my templates to their
needs
very easily.
Yeah.
So like on the fly.
Yeah.
Why do they need to buy software from a big company and then send them emails like, we need this feature, when they can develop the feature in 5 minutes in Notion?
So either hardcore deep tech that is serious IP that is extremely defensible, or hardcore business knowledge around very specific industries that like is that the knowledge is not available to like the average person. And then it comes with like a lot of experience and expertise, and then they build it for that specific, like for example, some very specialized procurement process for an industry, like in
right. My assumption is that software becomes commodity. It is very easy to build right now, and there's a lot of software that is already built.
Yeah.
So for software companies, it is very hard to do something new which is needed, and which is not there yet.
Yeah.
And not only software becomes commodity, also AI becomes commodity.
Right.
So when you have tools to integrate AI tools, the LLMs, with the software that you build in no-code environments like Notion or maybe Monday.com or Airtables or something like that, you have very powerful tools. You integrate your ChatGPT with it.
Yeah.
If you have some software skills and if you really understand how data structures work or how APIs work and how you can connect different pieces, then you can build very quickly anything you want, customized to your needs.
Right. On the AI side, it's interesting because like one conversation that we've had on the podcast a lot is whether these like so-called wrapper companies are in any way defensible, because it seems like with every iteration of a better model that comes out, they wipe out, you know, some portion of these companies that were just using some LLM API to build some feature around some products. What you're saying though is, if you pair that with some niche domain expertise that isn't even necessarily like something that you need to add to the LLM, like fine tune it with specific data or something, if you just are able to design it for a very specific workflow that is only understandable by someone with a lot of domain expertise, that you think is something that would be competitive in the industry.
So I think the problem is that defensibility is not in tech anymore. Unless you do like very deep tech, something very niche, very hard to understand for general public. But the typical software that you use is not defensible because you can replicate it like in a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. So the defensibility is not in tech anymore. It's very hard to build software that is defensible. So you need to come up with different approaches and different tricks to become defensible. It can be community. So right. The next kind of focus of creation is not the software. Software was the previous stage. Right now, it's communities. So if you can come up with an idea that can unite people into a community, which is healthy in its relationship with each other, then you can build something very defensible because people are reluctant to leave the community because right. it's interesting for them there. And then the software and the tech that you use in your company is just the environment where they just come and get together.
Right. Do you think user experience is a place that is you're able to build a competitive advantage? Like if you're building something around an LLM, which is not your tech, is just the fact of having a much better user experience than what you would get by using the raw LLM, something that is capable of becoming by defensible, I don't mean like the IP is defensible, but like something that you just won't get steamrolled over when the next version of GPT or some other model comes out.
I think it is an absolute requirement, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
You have to have it because in software, the requirements for software UX, and as much people use it nowadays, so mm-hmm. they require more and more efficient UX, because you need everything to do very fast, so you need a great UX to do that. So without that, you cannot be competitive. But even with great UX, it's not 100% guaranteed that you
so
will win.
So what would you consider the pillars to be? Okay, great UX then.
It is other components of the business. As I said, one of them is community. One of them is if you are in deep tech or in very kind of specific niche, mm-hmm. and you have your clients, they know you. Marketing, PR, kind of communication, educating people. So it's in different parts of business. It's not in tech itself anymore.
So it becomes like which company's sort of business chops and like execution chops are better than the other, which kind of is always has it been, right?
Yeah.
In many ways, yeah.
Because you buy water from the supermarket and it still works.
Right.
But the same water you can
get from your tap.
Yeah, get from the tap.
Yeah, branding does a lot of things with that.
So it is the... It is because the software becomes commodity. It is very, very easy to build software nowadays. Much, much faster. More people who understands how to build software, more people that understands what is the good UX and what is a bad UX.
I want to hear about specifically what you guys are exploring with AI, but just before staying on this topic of when thinking about what is worth or how do you compete in this world where, as you put it, software is completely commoditized. How do you, at the end of the day, though, still consider the evolutions of the models and what performance jumps in those models will render what you're doing to be obsolete? Is that something you think about?
What we do right now in that terms is we very actively use all the AI models. So I integrate ChatGPT into my daily workflow. Integrate no tools into my daily workflow. I organize my productivity with it. So I kind of try to solve the problem with the amounts of the information that I handle during my day with the tools that I have on my hands, like the no-code tools, organizational tools, AI tools, LLMs and stuff. So being able to focus in these amounts of information is a key for me. So it's the one key skill that I need to develop to be able to be successful. So I extensively use all the AI tools to help me to solve that problem.
And that gives you an intuition of what's going to be in sort of the next model that is not worth building today.
Right. So it also gives me an understanding of what is the next step. And if I use those tools, I also can understand what is needed in those tools and what is the next step that is needed for the community that uses that tools. Instead of being focused on old style business, which is like I can build you a software in 6 months or in a year. Yeah. So in VivaTech, I saw a company, a software development agency based in the UK called Build.ai, if I'm not mistaken. So what they do is they have a website where you come and you talk to an LLM, giving your requirements of what kind of software you want to build. Like, I want to build an airplane ticket selling agency software. I need to be able to handle like Visa, MasterCard payments, and maybe Apple Pay, and also like something else. So you talk to an LLM. After a while, it asks you questions and stuff. So it gives you, once you are ready, it gives you a full design of your application with all the user journeys ready, and you can modify each page. In each journey, you have all the screens. And under those screens, there's a price, like 400 euros or something like that, so each screen. So you can see what your app is going to look like and how much it costs you. And then the developers develop it according to your requirements. You have the requirements ready. You have your agreement with the company ready. You have an understanding of what you're going to get. And you have a price. And it takes you like maybe 10 minutes or so. So instead of talking to people for a week, for 2 weeks, so you can do it in 10 minutes.
Like, automates the procurement of orders for like development agencies, software development agencies.
Yeah, they are a software development agency.
They themselves are.
Yeah. That's their interface. Instead of having account managers and like salespeople, they have a website.
That's interesting. So what are you guys looking at in AI? What are the opportunities that you're most excited about?
So I don't think that just AI by itself is enough. So you need to multiply the AI with some industry. Traditionally, there are some industries and we have some verticals that we're mostly specialized in and we're mostly interested in. Those are real estate, like investments in real estate, management of real estate, operations in real estate, renewable energy, and like management of energy, in also investments in energy projects, or kind of renewable energy industry, and also fintech. So what we're doing right now is we're looking for opportunities to use AI in those industries in different scenarios. And also we just learn to use AI as much as possible.
What's the opportunity in renewable energy?
Oh, renewable energy is so interesting field. So there is a very big problem in energy sector right now. The need for energy grows like on a daily basis. And our grids were not designed to serve as much energy as it is needed.
In Armenia, you mean, or generally?
Generally. In Armenia, in European countries, the grid was built like maybe 100 years ago. Rebuilding it is very expensive. At some point, we're going to do that. But still, it is so expensive that countries cannot afford it. So, and also, the grid was not designed to get energy back from the customers. It was not designed to get the energy from solar. It was not designed as a network. It is designed as a centralized source and then delivery system. So having that and having all this renewable energy boom, the solar, wind, and everything else, like, and the need for energy creates a lot of problems that you can solve. And you can solve and earn a lot of money. Because energy is the foundational layer of our economy. Everything runs on energy. So if you are in energy business, it is all, you can always sell it. It's always needed. You can find people who need energy always. It's not a problem. It's it's kind of bread business. So and there are a lot of problems there.
But what's the opportunity specifically for applying AI to it?
Optimizing the grid, optimizing the, that's one of the most obvious problems that you can solve with AI. So you need to understand when you want to sell back your energy to the grid and when you want to hold it in your battery, for example, if you have a battery or local running in your house. So to do that, you need a model to train and understand what is the best moment to start selling the energy back based on your usage and based on the needs of the grid.
Is the energy market and like just the grid system in general liberalized in a way where you can make those kinds of decisions?
Yeah, it is liberalized in Armenia, as it is also liberalized in Europe and in the US. So it is a kind of free market where you can sell energy, you can buy energy from people. And also there are a lot of companies who use the AI to do trading on energy markets.
Trading on energy markets.
Yeah. Hmm. To decide when to buy, from whom to buy, for what price.
Interesting.
To do arbitrage on energy markets.
I'm having a hard time picturing the marketplace though. Like, how do you actually make the decision to buy energy?
It's a very typical marketplace. You put your like amounts of energy that you produce and the price that you want to sell it for on the market, and then people are bidding.
In the same way that large energy providers do.
It is the same in Armenia too.
Interesting. Except in the case of a large one, you don't bid. It's just that's the price that you pay.
You can have agreements with like there are different agreements with different dates, like different range of dates. You can you can have an agreement for a year with some company, but you don't buy from our main energy from the grid. You buy from a company that produces the energy,
and
you make the agreement on the marketplace.
So you almost go off grid.
Yes. Kind of. Okay. The grid has two responsibilities: to deliver the energy, and they also produce the energy. Like, what is the name of our grid? It's the HETS.
Right. Yeah.
It also produces and it delivers. So you pay for the delivery, and you also pay for the energy. And you can buy the energy on the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Then you paid for the delivery to the grid.
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. This was more of an internal project, but DeepMind's first algorithms that were commercialized, if you can call it that, were to maintain the energy supply for Google's data centers. Because at the time, like at the scale that they were operating, it was just far too energy intensive. And by you optimizing it with DeepMind's at the time AI algorithms, they were able to optimize it in a way where the energy consumption was more optimized and ultimately reduced. So it is interesting, the intersection of what opportunities there are there for AI and energy.
So if I'm not mistaken, Mark Zuckerberg made a comment about energy recently in terms of AI. So he said that the bottleneck of AI is not compute, is not the computational power, is the energy. Because if you want to make really big models, you need a lot of energy and you need big data centers. So, and you cannot build a 1 gigawatt data center because you need your own nuclear power station to run it. And there is no regulation to do that and no private companies allowed to do that. So energy is the business of the future.
But there actually is just one. Amazon just signed an agreement for a gigawatt data center that is nuclear powered, which blew my mind because I don't think they own the nuclear power plant. I don't think a private company can own one. I hope they can't own one. But it is crazy that the data center is. I don't want to get it wrong, but I think like solely powered by this nuclear power plant, which is insane. It is interesting that the like primary bottleneck moving forward will just be like, it's not just like in the past, like software iteration was just, okay, writing the next version of the software. Every time with a next generation AI model, it's not just writing the next model and making the algorithmic improvements.
Yeah.
It's building billions of dollars of infrastructure that will support the building of that model, the training of that model.
Right.
So it's a whole new world.
Yeah. And the energy is bottleneck here. And so there's a lot of movement and a lot of development in energy.
Yeah.
So it includes a new kind of nuclear reactors, the thorium reactors. A few companies that try to build a tokamak, the fusion reactor, So we also saw one company in VivaTech in France, by the way, founded by ex-Soviet Union scientists.
Fusion startup?
Yeah, one of two fusion startups in France, I believe. So a lot of deep tech and very like technologically advanced companies working in energy right now.
If you've been keeping up with that space, can you tell us where the state of fusion startups are? Because I feel like over the last few years, every year we get this like one headline about some incredible breakthrough in fusion, and it feels like every year we're sort of inching closer and closer to it becoming more of a reality. Like where are we today? What's like the sober analysis of where we are with fusion?
So they said that like for the last 50 years, they said it's 25 years away.
I heard now we're 10.
Yeah, so it's now like now progress. It's 10. And the proponents of doing like fusion energy and fusion reactors, they say that it's much better than doing thorium-based reactors and modular nuclear power stations. But it's on the other side, it's very hard. Because you need to create a sun in a limited space, basically. That's what you do.
But at this point, is it safe to say like in our lifetimes, we'll see it?
I don't want to make any predictions, but I hope to see it. Yeah. If we make one, it will change our lives like totally.
Can you explain why? Like what's the tangible effect on the average person's life?
You can express any kind of store of value in energy units. So money is energy.
Okay.
The basis of money is energy. Because if you need to do something, you need energy to do that. And if you have a lot of cheap energy and it becomes available to all the people...
So the cost of everything is...
Yeah, the cost of everything goes down.
Right.
And the opportunities to make things are a lot more than you have now. So there is one estimate that right now we produce, I think, maybe 2 kilowatts of energy per one person per hour, and we need maybe 20. So if we
need 20 to do what? Like
to live in heaven.
So we're living at 10% capacity right now.
Yes. So if we can come up with 10 times more energy, the whole the structure of economy will change. It will be a totally different life.
Interesting. 10 years.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
So it requires you to have a tokamak or a lot of thorium-based reactors or much more effective solar energy.
How would solar energy come into play for it? Do you mean as an alternative?
They say that for the final source of energy is going to be solar, but to come to that point and to have that effective solar panels, you still need time, and in that time we're going to use nuclear energy.
I see.
To make the transition.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah, because the KPIs of the solar panels that we have right now is like maybe 18%, if I'm not mistaken, and if we get to 25 or 30%, it's much more cheaper. And it will be compared, the prices of solar energy will be comparable to nuclear and like other efficient sources of energy. So once we come to that KPI levels, prices of energy will go down a lot.
Interesting.
And it also allow you to have very self-sustainable households.
Yeah.
And you can go off-grid.
Not just households, countries too, right?
Right.
Like the,
in our case, it's like strategic thing.
Like honestly, it feels like for almost every country, like energy and like oil, gas, and these things have become such huge levers for other countries to be pulling when they're putting pressure on other countries. It's fascinating to think of like. I'm sure it's a several decade long like transition, but when that time comes, just what a massive geopolitical change it would be for how countries view their relationships with
others. Absolutely. It will change our lives once and forever.
Yeah.
It will be a different world, less wars.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I feel like we'll find other things.
They say that all the wars are for resources, and resources are energy, basically.
Right. Then there's like water and other resources that I don't see. Does water wouldn't be solved, like, let's say, for through better energy, would it?
You can source water from the oceans. It is not that good quality as you source it from our mountains.
Yeah.
But you can source water from
the
oceans and seas.
Let's get back to tech. okay, so AI and no code are the primary areas that you guys are now exploring through GoXMath, you would say?
Yeah, on the technical, like on our daily practice, we do a lot of fintech, blockchain solutions, because it's still some place where you cannot do a lot of no code, low code solutions.
Yeah, sure.
You need a lot of security there.
Mm-hmm.
You go through a lot of security checks, security audits. So in blockchain, you cannot deploy your smart contracts on a daily basis. You cannot update them.
Right.
So if you have a problem there, if you have any kind of issue in your smart contracts, that's a real big issue for you.
Yeah.
Still, good engineers are of high value there.
Mm-hmm.
But for a typical SaaS, it becomes harder and harder to build a SaaS company.
Yeah.
Unless there is other opportunity here. So building a SaaS company on the technical side is much easier right now. So it can be a team of two people, maybe. They can build everything from scratch in a matter of months or weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find niches where you can sell to a limited amount of people who are ready to pay you, you can build micro SaaS companies without the need of VC investments.
Right.
So it changes the whole business model. Instead of going to VCs, getting like millions of dollars from them and aiming at $1 billion business with $1 billion, like $100 million revenue, you can build something in niche. You still sell to a limited amount of people and you earn a lot of money, like maybe $1 million a year, $10 million a year. Revenues can be like around $10 million a year. And you don't need a lot of people to do that. You are in a niche, so you have your audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know their problems. You can apply all the lean startup methodologies to your company.
Yeah.
You can do a lean startup without VC.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a different kind of business.
Yeah.
And it is possible to do that kind of businesses because of those no code, low code tools. And because of the amounts of automation that you have at your hands right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can connect all the services through the APIs, to the SDKs. It's very easy to do that. Yeah, you can use tools like such as make.com or Bubble to come up with very good solutions, very high quality solutions very quickly. And if you have people who need that, if you really understand the market and if you find a niche with enough customers, you can sell it to them without the need to raise funds.
Hmm. So it wouldn't be like a traditional venture-backed company that grows exponentially and stuff, but you would identify your market and just work on building a great business from day one and their revenue back.
Yes. Like
that. Yeah. If you're giving advice to entrepreneurs that want to explore those opportunities in microsauce, as you put it, how do you vet an idea? What are you looking for in there?
You use all the same techniques as you use in like typical startups, but the only difference is that you're not the financial model of the company is different.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to find a big market, like $1 billion market or $10 billion market, and you don't need to compete with people in those markets.
Mm-hmm.
So you just find a niche, you find an edge in the market with enough people in it, and you build a solution for them.
And preferably one that you have some domain expertise in.
Yeah. And you can leverage the existing marketplaces to do so. You can go to Salesforce marketplace and sell to people there.
Yeah.
Or Notion or any kind of platform which unites a lot of people. And you see that there is a need for this kind of application in that market.
Mm-hmm.
You build it and you sell it.
Yeah.
It's much easier in terms of also marketing, sales, because you have an existing audience, an existing place where people gather, and you know how to address them, you know where they are, and you can talk to them, you can get feedback from them. So basically you can apply all the startup processes to this limited markets.
Yeah. Just take VCs out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious to talk to you a little bit about just blockchain, the blockchain space more generally. So it's been a few years since the really big hype cycle that we saw of like 2021, 2020. Prices of cryptocurrencies have really gone up again over the last year. I think they're close to all-time highs. But more in the just general application space, there's a lot of like excitement and promise around the idea of like smart contracts and what Ethereum made possible when it came about. How do you and then there were NFTs and DAOs and things of that nature. How do you just evaluate where that ecosystem has gone over the last few years? Do you think, like, I personally don't use any, or that I know of, any blockchain-based app in my day-to-day life. Is there some area where blockchain is maybe being applied that will creep into my life and just the average person's life in the coming years, you think?
I think the most usable part of all the blockchain applications are stable coins. Mm-hmm. People use so much the stable coins. It helps to make your life easier.
Do they use it to buy like everyday things, or do they use it to buy other cryptocurrencies?
Mostly? They use it to transfer money.
Okay.
Just transfer money without being noticed by the central banks.
Like pay someone.
Yeah, pay someone, or send money to other country.
Right.
And so
that's still at the end of the day being transferred into fiat to.
Then you go to an exchange, blockchain exchange, and get your cash money.
Right.
In Armenia, it works. So yeah.
Right. But what about from like a more blockchain native type thing, if that makes sense, like end to end blockchain, like even if it doesn't necessarily have to do with some like specific financial transaction, or like if by financial transaction I just mean like paying someone in a traditional way, like.
Yeah.
What's an example of like a blockchain app that you think might sort of penetrate the market in that way in the coming years?
If we're talking about day-to-day payments, I think we're a bit away from that, because it is not only a technical problem; it's more of a political problem. Because if you want to use blockchain as your or Bitcoin or whatever kind of cryptocurrency you have for your day-to-day transactions, you need the whole economy to work on it. And that's a political kind of decision.
It can't be partial.
Ideological. Yeah. So it's very hard to just make the part of businesses, a small part of businesses, start working on it. So it's mostly used for all kinds of financial transactions, financial investments and stuff like that. It's a whole finance world,
right.
The blockchain world right now. It's mostly financial applications.
Right. Yeah.
That's decentralized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it is so much driven by politics, ideology, and like understanding of how the economy should work. It's not only a tech. It's tech mixed with political movements. Mm.
Is there something you're excited about today in the blockchain space?
I'm a big fan of Bitcoin. Yeah. So I believe in Bitcoin. And in the end of the day, I think Bitcoin will be number one. So
as it is now.
Yeah, yeah. As it is now. And as
has always
been. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the recent cryptocurrency and blockchain regulations that Armenia announced?
So Armenia uses the European regulation as a base, and that's not. I believe it's not a very good move, because it limits you in all the possible ways. Mm-hmm. The European market and European approach is to avoid all kinds of risks. It is not that capitalistic vibe, you know. It's more socialistic. It is concerned about the risks as much as possible. And for a country like us, I think it's more effective to use Singapore or the US or kind of more capitalistic kind of
libertarian kind of regulation
as a base for our country. Because we need to move fast. We cannot just pretend that it's safe to live, you know.
Right.
It is not safe for us, so we cannot do it safe also in cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, yeah.
If we want to develop, we need to take some risks.
Yeah, Europe maybe has that luxury more because they're much more developed economies, like their ecosystems are much more developed. But even then, that definitely leaves them behind the U.S.
And the overall vibes are different in Europe. It is more kind of very stable, 9-to-5 work. You know, it's just not the same in Armenia.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, Vanis, I was speaking to a mutual friend of ours, and I was told them that you're going to be on the podcast, and they asked them what I should speak with you about. They said, whatever you do, make sure you speak to Vanis about science fiction. tell me a little bit about what do you think the role of science fiction has been in your personal sort of career trajectory and development? Do you think it played a big role in the interest that you formed and ultimately the career path that you...
I just love science fiction. I love so many works in science fiction.
What's your favorite piece?
Oh, that's a hard question. I don't like to have favorite pieces.
Okay.
Yeah, but for example, the branding of our company, the Grogsmith, is based on a work, Stranger in a Strange Land,
yeah,
by Robert Heinlein. I love that work very much. Yeah, it's a great book. I love Star Wars,
yeah.
Rick and Morty and all the stuff, yeah. Yeah, and all the books,
yeah.
Asimov's books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Growing up, did you consume any Armenian science fiction? Like there's a few works from the Soviet era.
I know that Stepan Khazartyan wrote a book. Yeah. I saw it with my friends in my friend's hobby. I want to read it, but I never read anything like that. Maybe in Soviet Union times. There were a couple of books in Armenian.
Very limited. Yeah. And also there's a 1996 movie, a sci-fi movie.
Really?
Armenian sci-fi movie. The name slips my mind now. But it's a purely Armenian production. Like it's a post-independence production and probably one of the first movies produced in Armenia. Which is
what is the name of it?
I'll tell you after. I can't remember now.
Overall, I think that... So science fiction... there are some very prominent stories in science fiction, and the people who build tech right now, they read that books, yeah, and they are inspired by that books. So those books become kind of self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah, it's such a good way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah. So we live in an era of war of stories, mm-hmm, maybe. It's a narrative kind of competition of different narratives. And the stronger you have, the stronger narrative you have, the stronger are chances that you are going to win. Yeah. So the narrative should be very healthy. There should be very deep. They should be aligned with the reality that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the stronger you have, the stronger you have an understanding of the mm-hmm narratives, and the stronger is your position.
Yeah.
It's the same with our war with Azerbaijan. We have a different narrative. They have a different narrative. So it's a war. Besides the war on the ground, there is also a war of narratives.
Yeah. I think, like, for instance, we take for granted that, like, it's easy to say that the technology that we use day to day today, like being able to video chat with your mobile device,
mm-hmm,
being able to, like, send a message and someone getting it instantly. It's easy to say that those things would definitely have happened. Like it's just the natural trajectory of how technology developed. But it had to at some point be envisioned by humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're usually envisioned like 50, 60 years before it gets to tech in science fiction, right? Like if you look at Star Trek from the 70s,
mm-hmm,
a lot of like what you see now is totally like reality today. In fact, like a lot of it still isn't, but a lot of it is like even better than what you had in Star Trek, right? So it's I do think the tech would have probably been developed anyways, but without that being steeped into people's imaginations, it would have been harder to get to that point.
Right.
Like we know what we're aiming for thanks to the creativity of science fiction.
Yeah. They say that Star Trek predicted most of the technology that we use out of all the science fiction works. Yeah, but I also think that the power of science fiction is not only in prediction of any kind of technology, but also in understanding of how humans will act in new kind of situation.
Because
we still are the same humans.
Yeah.
and the situation changes, and how are we going to act, and how are we going to be in this all new kind of situations? That's the real question.
Yeah, in that sense, like shows like more dystopian, not just dystopian, but like these like more techno-philosophical movies and shows and books that like theorize about our interaction or how society will be formed when the advent of some new technology happens, are I think super important, because at a minimum they get the average people thinking about what they want their relationship with technology to be in society.
Right. Yeah. So I think one of the biggest challenges that we face right now is our relationship with AI.
Mm-hmm.
So our natural intuition or approach to anything is to give them agency or to give them a personality.
Yeah.
And we tend to give a personality to a program.
Yeah.
As we tend to give a personality to a doll.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you're a child and you play with a doll, you talk to it.
Yeah.
In the same way we talk to AI. But we also know that it's just a program.
We can't help ourselves.
Yeah, it acts as human. It talks to you in a quite professional manner. Yeah. But in the end of the day, it's a program. So mm-hmm. how we approach this, and how in a philosophical way do we want to give it agency?
Yeah.
And but like our tendency is to give it agency. When we talk about AI, we talk about it as a third person.
We use pronouns about it. Yeah.
So that's a very big challenge for us as humanity, because we need to really understand if we are going to give it agency or not.
What would you think about as a person, but also what you think the healthiest relationship with AI would be for yourself? Like, how do you envision that? What do you think the right way is? Just to simply think of it as a tool,
I'm not ready to give it any agency to AI. I'm not ready to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I still understand that it's a program. Because, so if we start doing something like that, we're going to mess with some of the basic, like the foundational narratives of our society and of our civilization. It's kind of the same story as with Adam and the gut. Gave Adam agency.
Right.
It gave him a free will.
That's
so once we do that with AI, we take the, you know, we kind of become gods ourselves. So it's a very like...
Or the opposite.
We should be very careful with that. And we face the challenge, and I don't know how we are going to manage it and how we're going to solve it.
Also, like,
because our institutions are not ready to do that.
Our institutions are not ready to do that, and history doesn't suggest that. Like, just the past decade or two decades of technological advancement, it doesn't seem like we're capable necessarily of always being able to put sort of the human side of, when it comes to like human computer interaction, just human technology interaction more generally, we seem to always err on the side of, well, this is just how it is now. Like, we're very conformist to, and we conform very easily to like these new realities around tech. And I think we have not been able to put any barriers between what is a healthy relationship with tech or not.
Right.
Like social media is a great example.
There are so many reasons for that. And the first thing that comes to mind is that the technology is very new. It develops so fast, and we still don't know how to relate to it in a healthy manner.
Yeah.
So we're kind of a child that saw that the thing for the first time, and we don't know how to work with it. So we need to learn that, and that's on our generation, so that the next generations interact with the technology in a more healthy way.
I think we've screwed the next generation up already. Maybe for the one after it.
And the second reason that comes to my mind is that our institutions, I mean the governmental institutions, are not ready to do that, because they are mostly focused on avoiding the risks. They are designed to do so. They're kind of thinking about how to minimize the risk in any kind of situation. And there is the second force, the entrepreneurial force, that develops things and that tries to see new opportunities, and they are not that risk averse. So these two forces, they don't have any kind of good method to tackle this kind of situation. Yeah. So the governments are not ready to handle this kind of technological yeah. advancement. So they don't know how to work with that.
Even for non sort of quote unquote societal or cultural issues, like even when just thinking about the possibility of millions of jobs no longer being as they were in a very short time span, like a 5 to 10 year time span, it doesn't feel like we have the political or economic systems that are able to absorb a problem like that.
Right.
But coming back to science fiction, do you think the lack of Armenian sci-fi content inhibits us in some ways about imagining the future in a, I don't know if it, in an Armenian context is the right way to put it, because to some extent sci-fi is very universal. But do you think we lose anything by not having Armenian science fiction, especially for like future generations?
I think there is a choice for every Armenian to learn other languages or to not. If you don't learn new languages, you're limited to your small
bubble,
small community, and the things that are happening in that small community. So you're forced to learn new languages, and you're forced to, through those languages, learn other cultures and other works of art and stuff. It is not about creating content in Armenian, but it is more about learning new languages to learn new content from all the other cultures.
But do you think, like for example, each culture's literary tradition, like for example, English literary tradition writes a lot of literature on like power structures, government, mm-hmm. like I think books like Animal Farm, for example, mm-hmm. probably, it's probably wrong to say, but like I think it could only come, not only come from, but it makes sense that it came from the English literary tradition. I think if you read like Dostoevsky and understand like Russian literature, Russian history, it makes sense why Dostoevsky came from the right. Russian literary yeah. tradition. Do you think like because the Armenian literary tradition doesn't have sci-fi, the Armenian sci-fi would be consumed by Armenian society first and foremost, obviously. That hinders, or not hinders, but like it's very hard to find the right vocabulary for this conversation, but like put something away from, take something away from for Armenian society.
So in this global economy and global world, I think we need to find what is the niche of Armenian language, because the language is the basis of the culture, and the culture is based on language, is built on language. So I believe that every single language and every single culture is a different type of mentality, different type of approach to things, and different way of thinking about life. And in that way, it's different colors. And when you have all the colors, you can come up with a great picture.
Yeah.
So Armenia is one of those colors, and Armenian language is one of those colors. So we need to understand what is the best, most effective, and most the best usage for this color. And what is the strong sides of Armenian mentality and Armenian language, and how is it different from, for example, English? And what is the mentality... And what is your way of thinking in Armenian language, and how is it different from the English or Russian or whatever? So if we understand that, and to understand that, we need to learn our language and we need to love it. Once we love it, once we learn it, we can find the best usage for it.
So like, what can be expressed in Armenian better than any other language? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Interesting.
We need to find an answer to that.
That's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
Hovhannes, what's something I should have asked you that I didn't? I think this is probably the longest podcast we've ever recorded.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, there are so many things. let me tell you about a place that I go a lot during the last few years.
Okay.
We found it in Egypt during the COVID times.
Okay.
So there was limited access to any country during COVID.
Yeah.
So the only place that we could go was Egypt. I'd never been in Egypt before that. So we just bought an all-inclusive hotel, something yeah. like that, in Sharm el-Sheikh. trip and go there. So, and I knew that there is a small village next to Sharm el-Sheikh in 100 kilometers from there, where a lot of extreme sports fans go. There is a great reef, one of the best ones in the world. So there are people who do kite surfing there. There are people who do all kinds of surfing. There is mountains next to the village. It's the Sinai is very mountainous. Mm-hmm. So it's desert, mountains, and the sea,
mm-hmm.
and like thin shoreline, along which you have few places where people live. So we went to this place. It's called Dahab.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small village. Like maybe like 10,000 people live there, and so a lot of sport fans come there, like divers and all those kinds of people. And you go to the sea. It's absolutely like amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
You just go two steps away from the shore.
Uh-huh.
There's so many corals and like the fishes there.
Yeah.
So we started going there. After that, I go to Dahab maybe 3 times, 4 times, or 2 times per year.
Uh-huh.
And I've never been in any other place in Egypt besides Dahab. So yeah. I encourage people to go there. It's very cheap. It's like maybe $300-$400 for the ticket. Yeah, and it's much cheaper than in Armenia, the life there.
Yeah,
the restaurants, yeah, you can eat for like $5 or maybe $2 or something like that. And the nature is so great there. And if you love sea, if you love water, if you love any kind of water activities, it's the best place to go. Yeah.
First ever vacation recommendation on EVN this trip.
All right then.
Last question, how about is, where do you hope to see Groksmith in 5 years? The traditional question, of course.
So for Groksmith, I see that we need to adapt to the new reality and become a kind of new generation, next generation agency. So we were in a process of finding that formula. What is the new type of agency work in this new reality? I also, in the process of the brainstorming and finding new ideas about new type of businesses. So that's why I think so much about energy sector, energy industry, or real estate. And basically, I look at all the industries that are not digitized yet, because there are a lot of opportunities there. It's agriculture also. So in software and in the world that we live, the optimizations are about like half a click. You're one click away, or you 2 clicks away. That changes the whole situation.
Right.
But in agriculture, it's not about that. Yeah, so you can get a lot of value add by just doing simple things. So I believe that the big opportunities are in those fields that are not digitized yet, and in the markets that are not digitized yet. So on one hand, I'm in a process of changing that strategy of Groksmith to become a next level, new generation agency which serves people in the new way and in the new reality. And on the other side, I also exploring new opportunities in all the other industries that can be digitized.
Right. This is one of the most fun conversations we had on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
We really covered a massive spectrum. So thank you so much for coming on, and hope you'll come back on again to continue. Thank you, Anas.
Thank you.